is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're listening to News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained since January 1997. We began our 25th year in broadcasting in January 2022, and we're just getting started, exploring the edge of human consciousness and possibility on planet Earth with founder and journalist Nicole Marie Whitney at the helm. What's really real? And what's really possible? That is what we want to know. Join us at newsforthesoul.com. newsforthesoul.com.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
And it is Saturday, 1 p.m.-ish Pacific time. Heavy on the ish. And we are now connected. We're now live. It's time for Open Search Outward. I just realized we don't have our fancy schmancy intro set up yet. Perhaps by next week. I'm sure it will involve lots of reverb and echo on the outward, outward, outward.
I can hum a song or something.
And yeah, I think so. Yeah, it'll be neat. We'll see what they turn out next week. Meanwhile, that's Dave, former CIA remote viewer and guest on this show for a life sentence at this point, about 25 years.
Since 1997.
Yeah. Wow. Really need to do the ticker tape parade. And me, Nicole from News for the Soul. All right, so we are here, as the intro had said, we've been on a quest here for that long to find out what's really real, what's really possible. And together, we search those possibilities and potentials and apparently debunk a whole lot of crap along the way on the show.
Did I pop a bubble?
You popped a bubble. But I'm not letting it go. So we'll talk about that one later. Yeah. Anyway. Do you know the... Oh, yeah. No, later. Okay. So, Dave, what's new?
Yes. Well, we just finished a really fun clubhouse meeting. You know, I do these marathon talks all night on Clubhouse on Fridays, and we had a fun one last night. We did Synchrodestiny, and we were going to do the show with Michael Nitti, who's my really good friend for many, many years, and Michael had some amazing synchrodestiny stories. He was going to start. He's a platinum and lion life coach for Tony Robbins and others. And he has been, he also has his own private clients. Just really amazing client list. They will never let you say the names of people, but these are people that you see on screen and people, nice. You know, that are running big industries and, you know, he is the coach for them, right? Or for their wives or something. Whatever is needed. It's interesting. You know, people are extraordinarily successful, but they can't keep a relationship. Or, you know, they are extraordinarily successful, but their employees hate them. Or they're extraordinarily successful and, you know, they don't know what to do next, those kinds of things. So he is one of many that are really skilled at that level. And he's extraordinarily loved by his clients. But what I wanted to do with him is to have him tell synchrodestiny stories, because he's got a zillion of them. And if I, you know, I had a couple, I'd throw them in. But I was explaining the quantum mechanical interpretations of synchrodestiny, why that is from a scientific perspective. And also, so, not debunking. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do you define synchrodestiny?
Yeah, well, synchrodestiny is a creation. The term was created, coined, you know, kind of owned by Deepak Chopra. And he started, you know, wrote his Synchrodestiny books, and he was doing Synchrodestiny classes. And, you know, to give you an example of what it is, I mean, there are a number of people that kind of commonly refer to it as strange coincidences that you're meant to recognize. Strange coincidences that you're meant to recognize. Carl Jung said strange coincidences that with a spooky aspect that you are meant to recognize. I thought that was clever. Spooky aspect. That was Jung. So Deepak, of course, brought it out of that and defined it much, you know, in the same way, but wanted to hear give stories. So what I have is a story about that. This will illustrate it for you. So Michael, who he got sick and he's in the hospital and he's not getting out till tomorrow, so he wasn't on the show last night. So I you know, callously stole his story, told it last night in his absence, so I could use it because you weren't there. You got sick. That's your fault. So the story was this. He was the director of operations at Tony Robbins, and Tony Robbins was kind of, the whole Robbins corporation was kind of run like a family. And he gets with this like huge business consultant guy that you would know the name if I could remember it right now, but he's a huge successful. It's like the Warren Buffett of business design and management. And he convinces Tony that he's running his company like a family. He needs to run it like a business. So Tony being Tony goes, yeah, okay. Well, tell me what I need to do. This is the start of the Synchrodestiny story so you can understand how it works.
Okay.
So this guy says, I'm going to send you a new vice president who will come in here and shake this all up and structure it like a corporation and run it like a corporation as it should be run. So this woman is taken from this guy's staff and is migrated laterally over to Tony's staff and comes in, and she was really aggressive. And one of the things that she started doing was looking at husband-wife teams in the company. Well, Mike, of course, and his wife, Julia, they're in the company. And so what happens is this woman decides, well, look, Mike, we can't have this. So one of the two of you are going to have to go. So Michael says, look, I want to be a good soldier and play along on this. I don't want to fight you on it. So there are some openings over at Deepak. Let's say, what if Julie goes, you know, my wife goes over to work at Deepak. Is that okay? And then I can stay here in my current position. And the decision was yes, so she goes to Deepak, his wife. She's working with Deepak Chopra at the Chopra Center in La Costa, California. I can remember this. And then what happens is Deepak is introducing Synchrodestiny into his core POI lineup of things he talks about. So Michael goes to a Synchrodestiny lecture, class, whatever you want to call it. He's thinking to himself, this is amazing. You know, I'm in here. I'm here because my wife is here. I'm here because, you know, the woman, the new CEO said that she had to leave. So now I'm here, and I'm sitting here for a free class listening to Deepak. And there were only a couple of open seats. He goes and sits in a seat next to the aisle. There's one more seat right next to him. He notices a man standing in the back talking to some people. And he glances and he thinks to himself, that's a familiar face. He sits down in his seat, and then 20 seconds later, this man comes over and sits down right next to him, looks at him and goes, hey. And then looks over at Deepak, because Deepak now goes, welcome everybody to Synchrodestiny. I want to, I want you all to give a round of applause to our special guest. And the man stands up. And he says, I want him to share with you this Synchrodestiny story. So this man standing in a dark suit, open collar, you know, tone on tone, looks out and says, yeah, I'm an actor. I just want you to know, I mean, yeah, you might recognize me, but I want you to know what my beginnings were like. You know, I wanted to be an actor. I studied to be an actor. I considered myself an actor, but for years, when I put myself out there after school and things, I couldn't get a part. I couldn't get an audition. Or if I did get the audition, the part was completely wrong and I never got it. So I was working all of these jobs, like, you know, bussing tables, being a waiter, janitorial stuff. I was doing that kind of thing just to, you know, pay for a one-room apartment and a one-room, you know, bungalow and food. You know, it was miserable. But I never lost sight. I never gave up the fact that I was an actor. I identified as an actor. I called myself an actor. I lived, you know, like an actor. I was constantly practicing my acting skills, even though nobody cared. So I'm walking down the street one day, and he goes, I don't quite remember where I was going, but there were people on the sidewalk with me, and suddenly there's a huge, loud bang, and it's up above us. It's like somebody dropped something on a roof. So everybody just kind of stops and looks up because it was really loud. It caught everybody's attention. And as he's looking up, he says, I don't see what caused the noise, but I notice there's a window, and underneath the window there's a sign, and it's on the second story, not like down at the street level. I had to look up to see this. And it says Simmons and Company, established, and it gives his birth date. It's his birth date on the sign. And so he goes, that must mean something. You know, that must mean something. So he wanders around trying to find the entrance to this place. He beats on the door, and he goes, I beat on this door well past the point of any sane person staying here, because nobody was answering it. But he kept beating on the door because he was certain, you know, he's like, I've got to find this out because my birth date's on this building, under the window. Finally, an elderly woman cracks open the door and goes, yes, you know, with an agitated face. And he goes, I'm sorry, but I'm supposed to be here. I just feel like I'm supposed to be here. My birth date's on, you know, out there on the sign for your whatever this is. And she opens the door a little wider, and he looks in and he goes, oh, he sees a man standing on a box, and a man is measuring a suit on him, and the man's wife is sitting next to him. And he looks around and he goes, he can instantly tell this is an extraordinarily high-end tailor shop. He said, I looked over at a tuxedo that was on a mannequin, he goes, and it was really clear to me I could never afford not even a shirt out of this place. But I'm here because I'm supposed to be here. The woman keeps asking him, why are you here? I mean, what are you doing? What are you beating on the wall? He goes, I'm supposed to be here. She goes, she goes, you're not on the schedule. You have to have an appointment to be here. No, you're not supposed to be here. He goes, no, I'm supposed to be here. I'm telling you. And she goes, well, what are you doing? What are you? And he says, I'm an actor. I'm an actor. Like that. All animated, you know, big smile on his face. The man standing on the box being fitted for a suit says, because obviously at this point, everybody stopped, turned, and they're looking at him. And the man on the box goes, well, I'm a Hollywood director. And he goes, come on over here. And so he takes out a card. He hands it to this man. And he says, that was pretty impressive, what you just did in the doorway. And he said, here's my card. Go down to this studio, down to this theater group. He said, you find the director that's there. Here's her name. You tell her that I gave you this card and that I said for her to find something for you to do there. He goes, now listen to me. It may just be painting props for the next 3 years, but you need to be willing to pay that price, because if you'll pay that price and live that life, eventually you will obtain what it is that you want to obtain. He goes down, thanks the man very much, thanks the elderly couple, apologizes to the wife, heads on down the street, goes straight to that theater company and walks in and goes, hey, here's who I am, here's a card, this gentleman and I just talked, he said that I should talk to you about getting a position here, and, you know, he said you would do that. I'll take anything. So the director of this theater company gives him some, you know, menial task to do, but they're holding tryouts for the next, you know, for their next performance. And so he tries out. He does the audition. He gets the part. It's a lead. And from that point forward, Gerald Butler becomes the A-list actor that you now know him to be, right?
Wow.
Gerard Butler. Yeah,
Gerard.
Crazy story, right?
Wow.
Gerard, yeah, I always mispronounce it. that was the synchrodestiny story that Deepak wanted presented to the start off his seminar on synchrodestiny. And I got interested in that to say, because Mike and I were going, I was going to now try to explain the science of that. And I started looking around, and as typically, you know, I find all these different interpretations of synchrodestiny. I find people that go through these elaborate processes of, oh, there's seven kinds of, you know, synchros or synchrodestinies. You know, there's the deviation synchrodest, this deviation sync. There's the, you know, precursor sync. There's the post sync. There's all, they go through all this stuff, and I've actually read through it all. And then I think to myself, well, that just muddies the water for everybody, doesn't it? I mean, it not anywhere in there does it say, what does synchrodestiny mean? They pitch it, they're presenting it like it's just crap that happens and you just go for the ride kind of thing. And it's not that. There's not, there was no input and no teaching into how is it that these coincidences that you're supposed to pay attention to actually occur. Well, you know the answer to this because you've heard me talk about it 1,001 times. You know, it's all about how you're resonating in the moment, right? It's mm-hmm. all about the energy that you're putting into your life in the moment, the energy that's a positive, you know, directed, focused, uplifting energy. You know, Gerard Butler could have walked around with his tail between his legs, slinking around because he's a failed actor, right? And all he's doing is picking up other people's dirty dishes or delivering their food and handing them a check. Or he took on the perspective that he did moment to moment to moment to moment in his life. He walks down the street, hears a noise, looks up, sees a sign, sees his birthday up there, and accepts that out of his positive attitude in the moment. He didn't say what a depressed, failed actor would say, which was, okay, so what, my debt's my birthday. That's weird. And walked down the street. He, again, in that moment, followed that trail because that was the kind of energy that he was putting into his life. And look where that takes him, sequence after sequence after sequence after sequence. But he was in control of it every second of every moment, wasn't he?
So he literally
the
raising
off
of the
wheel.
Frequency?
What's that?
So it was literally the raising of his frequency, period?
Well,
his frequency is probably better just expressed as his resonance. You know, he was upbeat, positive. He never gave up on what he wanted to be, what he felt his purpose in this life was. He didn't let external things, you know, sway him from that particular path. It's the kind of stuff that Werner Erhard, you know, taught so much that people often didn't understand, which, you know, was like the Landmark Forum and things. You know, people go into Landmark Forum and I know because I was there. Patty tricked me into it one time. And you know, I was one of the people that was easily irritated because I didn't get it. You know, I didn't understand it, what they were trying to do. And there's a skillful approach that they go for in that, which is, you know, that people will say, well, can we take a break? And the facilitator will say, well, no, we really feel that this is important. We would like you to stay and we would like to continue. And then people will get irritated by that. An hour, another hour goes by, and somebody will say, look, we need to have a break and have a bathroom break. And the facilitator will say, we'd really like to continue. We feel that the content here is very important. We don't want to miss anything. And they get more irritated. And pretty soon, if somebody will stand up and they head for the door, and there will be a staff member standing at the door that will say, we would really like you to stay because we feel that you know, what's going on in here is important. We don't want you to miss anything. And people then accuse them of, like, preventing them from going to the bathroom and stuff. They get completely irate, unhinged. And here's the deal. I mean, I can save you all the price of a landmark forum. What they're presenting to people is it's how you're reacting to the moment. We're not going to stop you from going out. All we're doing is saying that we think the content's important and we would like you to stay. That doesn't mean you can't leave. You see what I mean? People can get up and go and talk to the staff member can say that, and you could say, okay, yeah, but I'll be right back and go pee and then come back into the seminar. But people start accusing them of locking them in the room, and this anger just flourishes and it spreads like a cancer across the room. And it's amazing to see it. And what it was not, I went through the whole day just being all pissed off. I mean, literally pissed off, frustrated. People controlling my life, telling me what I have to do and can't do. And the truth of it is they weren't doing any such thing. That was the energy, the emotion that I was putting into that. So the whole point of Werner Erhard's teachings was simply that your life is moment to moment what you choose to make it or what you choose to layer onto it. You can choose promise, possibility, living as the observer, right? Or living an authentic life, resonating powerful, believing in your purpose and believing in your calling and et cetera. Or you can live your life pissed off, reacting to what people are saying or doing. And what you recognize is that you have to recognize that you must own that. That's what they call your stuff in the landmark forum. That's your stuff. That's your story, right? And it's amazing when the light bulb comes on in your head, because the rest of the seminar then becomes something quite emotional just in terms of watching people when that come to that. That they have themselves assigned all of this negativity to their life and embraced that and used it to define their life. In this idea of synchrodestiny, it is it's not just a roller coaster ride of things happening because they're happening. You know, it is something that you are very much in charge of. You can absolutely be in charge of that, and you can create those patterns of potentials that you would start to call coincidences that should be recognized. But those patterns of potentials occur because of how you're resonating in the moment, how you are resonating in the moment, how you are thinking, being, acting, right? Inculcating the positive promise and possibility in your life, or sitting back and, you know, casting doubt, shadow, anger, you know, finality, it's over, I'm a failure, I can't do this, I can't do that. Then, you know, there are people who are teaching synchrodestiny incorrectly, in my opinion, who are basically then going to say, okay, great, you just take your hands off the handlebars of your life, and now I'll tell you, you know, what the precursor synchros are and the deviation synchros, and I'll tell you how the world, right, which is called the change distribution, right, meaning the collective moment, all the different moments impacting us. Take your hands off steering wheel of your life and then watch what happens. Yeah, damn tootin', you know, it'll take you on some vortex ride through all different kinds of things. And, you know, and you may notice that you may not, but some people have done that, have come to that point.
Oh,
Butler
yeah.
did not, you know. He did not,
so,
nor did you, nor have I.
There's two points coming to me. Firstly, the visual of Dave pissed off, arms folded at an S seminar. Hilarious.
mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's another
yeah.
aspect. There's another aspect to this, though, because I get the Lincoln frequency. Definitely hands remain on handlebars, for the love of God. But there's another aspect to this. Like, as you were telling the story of the boom at the right moment in the right spot on the sidewalk and the sign in the right place at the boom in the right, and then the connection to recognize, oh, that's my birthday, and then the connection to recognize, oh, that means something, I'm supposed to be in there, but not like there's, and I know you're going to be all over this, but there's a divine intervention aspect to this. Like, what are the odds of all that, right, in that moment?
Yeah, I'm
here we go.
Well, you have to understand that I gave up on this idea of the divine. And after 35 years as a high priest in the Mormon Church and serving at the levels that I served, and then seeing and understanding the pablum that organized religion became in my mind, that I felt hypocritical in saying the things that I said and standing in the role that I stood in, you know, as a first counselor in a stake presidency and second counselor in a bishopric, kept passing judgment on people for all manner of things, you know, voting to excommunicate people, and all the while standing up and saying the things that I said. Like that I've heard the word of God, or that, you know, I've received revelation and this and that. I never did. I was just making it up. I was doing what was expected of me and playing the part. And so
it's,
I never saw God,
though.
I never saw any of those divine things. So where I'm at with that is, when you say divine to me, I have to look at my life in, you know, working and studying in that role, because even when I was at BYU, every semester at BYU had to take a religion class. You could take religions of the world and this and that. It wasn't LDS religion. You could any kind of religion class. So I always did. So you really kind of come out with a sort of a semi-scholar in theology, right? Depending on how deep you want to go with some of the stuff. And you start finding out things about how the Bible was really written. You start finding out things about evidences for Christ, and you find out that, you know, the evidences against outweigh the evidences for. You start to see these things being asked to be accepted on a basis of faith, which to me is like a no-win, you know, game of you have to accept it on faith. You have to believe it sight unseen, and if you don't believe it sight unseen, then you're not going to get the reward at the end. So
to me
is difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You got to stop connecting those two things, man-made stuff, and we're going to get mail. But I mean, I don't associate any man-made religion with my direct experiences with this unseen thing that I've had. We wouldn't be sitting here talking.
Well, what do you think the source
of
it is?
Well, I don't know. That's why I do the show.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I'm talking about the real thing, not anything to do with theological study. That's the opposite direction to me. That's just like those people trying to break down the different levels of the synchrodestiny and get all fiddle farty in the way and mess the whole thing up, right? So
yeah, they're creating a belief structure around something they're coming up with,
like,
and then selling it on YouTube.
Get in the way. Yeah, no, I'm talking about the real thing. And I think this is why we balance each other out on this search that we're taking together.
Because, yeah, of course it is.
You know, like, look at what happened when we were naming the show. Love Dave, he's like a walking thesis guy, right? He sent me this long attachment with all these potential names that I kind of glazed over. And I tuned in to my invisible, weird, divine intervention team that got me on my path. Immediately thought, no, it's open search outward. It sort of reminded me a bit about Nimoy show earlier. What was that called? It was something search. It just reminded me of that, and then it tied it in to remote viewing, and it felt powerful. And
is it Leonard Nimoy? Leonard Nimoy?
Yeah, he did a search something in the 70s, exploring the unknown. So it tied it in with that, with what we do, with who you are, with what I'm doing. And it was just one thing. And that was downloaded from the upstairs team, as I put it. Like, that, you know, that wasn't me researching. I didn't Google anything, right? So what's that, Dave?
In Search Of, that was the name of the show.
Ah, In Search of, yeah. There you go. Oh, I love that show.
Yeah. 76 to 82.
Yeah. You're on Google now, aren't you?
I truly appreciate and love the fact that you have a belief in divine intervention of things.
It's not a belief. It's a direct experience.
I know, but it's a direct experience that and where I am with it is I'm cool with that, and I appreciate that people have that. I'm not an atheist, and I'm not really an agnostic at all. What I believe is that the eternal and the divine, the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent aspect is us, each of us, that we were gifted with that ability. And what I keep asking and putting out there is just think, if all of us born into this existence were gifted with that ability, and we were, why were we gifted with that ability and who gifted it to us? It boils right down to passages of the Old Testament, which speaks to the free agency of humanity. Free agency, meaning that we are here to, given these gifts, and we were supposed to be using these gifts to exercise our free agency to live rightly. And we became such a, we immediately fell into the things that that drive us even to this day, greed and war and murder and, secularism and so forth. And it was a creation of us. I've never, ever, turned around when somebody would say, why doesn't God stop this? I would look at people and go, if there's a God, God has nothing to do with this. God is not starting war, and he's not stopping war, or he or she, but whatever you want to look at it. That was not in the formula. We created this. We did this to each other. We decided, what was important enough to us to kill and butcher and man. We did that, not God. God had nothing to do with it. So when you talk divine, I love hearing it come from you. And it softens my heart to know that you, as wonderful a person as you are, that you have that attachment to the divine. I need to try to figure out, what that is, where we came from, and why we were put here, and why we were given these gifts we were given, and then why what we did as soon as we possibly could was to create stories and belief structures. False stories and belief structures that took those abilities away from us, and then told us that these things unseen that we have to accept on a basis of faith, that they are the divine. They are omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. They are eternal, and you have to live rightly here following our edicts, right? You will never attain that.
That's the opposite of divine.
That was my life. That's how I grew up. That's how I was, that's how I grew up as a young man, experiencing that and being, buying it hook, line, and sinker for many, many years, and then coming to this realization after being trained as a remote viewer that, I can't accept that anymore. So I don't know how or why there would be divine intervention in the path of each human. I do understand or accept that in the path of life of each human, that it is how that human chooses to live, how they choose to resonate, how they choose to serve, how they choose to contribute, how they choose to fulfill other, human needs. But the top needs, the things that are most fulfilling are the things that are contributing, giving back to the society, to the global society, to the human race, giving service to fellow humans into the human race, doing those things, filling your heart with love and compassion, giving up the requirement to be right. Those are the kinds of things that I believe are our responsibility moment to moment. And I do love you that you come up with, that you throw something out there like the divine, because for me that's like, that's, I don't understand where it would come from and why it would influence. I mean,
well,
I appreciate the fact that you feel it does, but I don't understand it, why it would.
Well, which is why the direct experience aspect is key in all of this. And I don't have any more answers than you do. I've got more questions maybe, but, you know, and thus here we are on an open search outward, and it looks like we're looking for the same answers in the end.
Yeah, I mean, the answer for me is that humanity is responsible for humanity, and individuals are responsible for themselves. The only thing you're in charge of is right now. You know, there's so many spiritual teachers that have thrown that out there. The only thing you're in charge of is right now, and people don't get it. It's just like, you know, some do, some don't. I asked, you know, Patty when we were sitting in this landmark forum, because the facilitator was, you know, this was a sharp woman sitting in the chair, and nothing, no amount of anger or, you know, bile coming out of somebody's mouth, it didn't shake her at all. I mean, she was skillful at turning it around and dissecting these people into, you know, little pieces to help them understand, to the point they just broke down crying because, you know, they knew she was right, and it was their own game, their own shtick, their own story that they were running on themselves and had been running on themselves for sometimes 40, 50, 60 years, right? And when you realize that, it's a big awakening for them. So on the drive home, I'm going, why would somebody want to be a facilitator of that, to set up at the front of the room and listen to that from, you know, 100 people or 150 people? Why? And Patty just doesn't seem to look at me. She goes, because they have chosen to live impeccable lives, and that's how they live. That's a powerful statement, is it not? They have chosen to live impeccable lives. That's why they are there. And that's why they are not influenced by the anger of others. They are there. Their calling and their purpose is to help these people, to help people find the solutions to what's broken in their lives. And we all have broken parts somewhere in us. And the question is, how do you address that? How do you embrace that? How do you, you know, not give it the kinds of things that darken your life and you know, and fill you with sadness and hopelessness and that kind of thing? So I wish I could say that I have chosen to live an impeccable life. I wish I could say that. But what I can say is that people like you, people like my clubhouse moderators and Patty and so many others, all the students, remote viewing students, have always made me want to be a better man. And that is a significant thing for me, because I really thought I was on top of my game as a young man, and found that I was not on purpose, and there was much that needed to be altered in my life as a remote viewer when I got awakened, you know. I thank you for being you and being where you've been in my life since, you know, you walked into a classroom back at University of Vancouver. And yeah, you know, all these experiences, this long chain of synchrodestiny events of meeting people, you know, person has caused me to say to myself, I want to be a better man for them. It doesn't mean I haven't stumbled in front of, but it is what I want to be, and it's always on my mind. It is part of me trying to be responsible for me moment to moment. And I feel so much that it's our lives are our lives to either cast away or to live richly and impeccably. It's up to us. And I don't know what the external forces would be that would, you know, that would modify, or to use an army term, grease the skids on our life in some way. But I love it that you think that. I mean, it's good. And I know there are probably a lot of listeners that think that, but I want people to really be responsible for people.
Yeah. That's a big point of, you know, all of this is to be open-minded, but not to the point where your brains are dribbling out your ears. So, you know, that's why we talk about.
Or not to the point that you're expecting something else to do something for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and that people have a, humanity has a tendency to rapidly assimilate that ideology into their lives, expecting that something else is going to make it better, right? Or that something else is responsible for making it worse. You know, and anytime you're surrendering to that kind of an outlook or a belief, to me, it means that you're not taking responsibility in the moment for what you've done or not done or how you're living. And, you know, it's I don't want that to sound as an arrogant, and it may, but I don't want it to sound as an arrogant statement. For me, it's not an arrogant statement. It's very much a humble statement of accepting, you know, failures in my life and choices that were bad in my life, but also recognizing the strength that I gained from those and the experience and the wisdom that I gained from those. And I feel very comfortable in taking charge for both my failures and my successes and where I am at this point. And again, I love the fact that you are willing to embrace that there's another power that's influencing, you know, some of these things that you're, you know, in what we're talking about, these synchrodestiny events.
Well, my path was a lot different than yours, which we'll get into, I'm realizing, here and there as we go. But it was a lot easier for me to see a light go on when you're dark. And, you know, I didn't have any support. I was literally just this single-celled amoeba in this primordial look. And so it took a direct experience with something outside myself, or seemingly out. I mean, it may be our higher self, or maybe we're all God and we're all in it. I don't know. I don't even like using the G word because there's too much, you know, abuse around
that. Too many different
yeah.
things.
We need, you know, new terminology for something we don't understand, and who knows if we'll even ever understand it. It was easy for me to see is the point. It was like, and that's what it took for me to wake up. I mean, how did your, okay, do you have a scientific theory? Because I know you can draw a scientific graph anywhere at the drop of a hat to explain any of these theories. So what was your explanation for the ludicrous, you know, the boom right when he was in the right spot of the sidewalk, and then the sign, and then the birth date, and then the weird response to, you know, acting like a maniac, and then the Hollywood director standing right there? Like, what are the odds of all of that, and how did you compute that into the equation of your explanation?
Well, let's back it up all the way to back to Michael and Julie, right, and to Tony Robbins. I mean, all of these things are a sequence that goes into that starts that when you're saying that this sequence of events or coincidences begins to happen and you're supposed to pay attention to it. The supposed to pay attention to it part is saying that you're responsible for how you are reacting to these things. The fact that those potentials, you know, exist or that they happen, they just happen. I mean, they're actually not part of, you know, the lineup of something. So when Tony Robbins believes some guy that's a corporate, you know, mogul that says you're running your stuff as a family, that's Tony Robbins' decision. And the other guy, you know, I laugh about it because I said, do you really think that the guy that's running his company and is this, you know, butcher, you know, I mean, like this laser-focused corporate, you know, guy, do you think that he sent laterally over to you his best staffer? You understand what I mean? So, of course he didn't. I mean, what kind of fool would do that? I mean, who would take somebody out of your staff that was working for you in your corporation effectively and making your corporation make more money and work more smoothly. Right there is a decision made by a guy to send somebody who was probably, you know, a lower performing member on his team, not the lowest, but, you know, not the top either, to Tony, who Tony then embraces and says, make it happen. That person calls in Michael and says, your wife can't work here anymore because I don't want it to be a family. It's got to be a business. Michael could have said, I quit. You know, or I'm out of here. But he said, no, let me work the deal where she can go over to the Chopra Institute. And she does. That's a decision then made by Mike. And then Julie in the Chopra Center says there's this synchronicity thing, and maybe you want to come and do this. That's a decision made by her. He goes. He sits right next to Gerald Butler. Gerald sits next to him. He hears this amazing synchrodestiny story. So now let's analyze that story. There was no big divine intervention to make a boom or, you know, something drop on the roof. Something just dropped on the roof. You know, somebody did something and it fell off the forklift or, you know, who knows, whatever it was, and it fell off the forklift. The decision by Butler to look up, as everybody else did, that's just a decision in the moment. Wherever he was going. But it was a decision in the moment to see that sign and then accept that in his definition of who he was and who he was supposed to be, to see that sign and say, that must mean something. And, you know, it could have been 1,000 other people in that same situation look up and say, oh, it's my birthday, so what? And walk down the street. But he chose to do that. He chose it. Got, you know, some divine intervention didn't put Simmons and Company established on his birthday. That happened when Simmons and Company established that birthday.
We don't know that because the other people, you know, that's the part that we don't know. We don't know that. I'm going to challenge you on that.
I know it.
Because we don't know that. And I'll tell you, here's the missing piece. Here's the missing piece is it'd be most appropriate to be asking Gerard these questions, because when here's the difference between a divine connection experience as opposed to all the left brain, you know, regurgitation, is there's a knowing and a connection prior to, during, and after of the experience, out seemingly external, coming from somewhere else. That's the difference. That's when I know.
That's not what you know. That's what you read.
That's not what I read. That's what I experienced in the moment. In the moment.
Okay.
We're going to have fun with this one. Oh, my God. An hour's gone by already. Okay, I put on an extra hour this time. Thank goodness.
Yeah, and we're going to have to cut that, like, maybe at, like, 15 minutes short if we can, because I have to – I have another engagement. I apologize. It just got thrown at me. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, we can just do our normal hour and then pick it up next time and leave everyone at this exciting cliffhanger. Also, by the way, as you're talking, I'm thinking, hey, Netflix pitch, the next big hit show, Synchro Destiny. Let's talk.
Really?
Brilliant.
Really? Synchro Destiny's up on Netflix. See, that's synchro destiny.
Is it all already up there? Oh.
Is it?
No. Maybe it's not. Let's find out. Okay, now I'm on Google.
See, because how I was just acting in the moment, I just skewed that off out into some other destiny, synchro destiny trail. I sent that potential off out into, you know, someplace else where it'll land.
I'm Googling it now.
Later date.
TV show. There we go. Nope. There's a talk on Deepak Chopra. It's wide open there. Patent pending. Okay, there we go. So, Dave, is there any moment you can think of? I mean, you have a very left brain approach. I'm sure you agree with that, right?
Really, you think? I mean, I live in my right brain a lot, and that I was trained as a scientist, so I, you know, even though I was an Army officer, I was scientific about a lot of things that I did, particularly like training, you know, and I think that I live in my right brain a lot, and I'm very emotional about being in my right brain, but I am also very careful to try to come back to and scientifically analyze what it is I'm experiencing and what others are experiencing. And I've spent decades, Nicole, trying to take really complex interpretations of things, which seem to be like the most popular crap that people throw out there today. It's like they just love to stand up and seek some sense of significance in their life. It happens a lot on Clubhouse. People will come in and start talking, and I can hear in the first sentence, and I've told the moderators, I can tell in the first sentence what this person is trying to do. And people will come in and speak fantasy physics, you know, where they're tossing out words and other stuff, and it's like, stop it, you know, you're speaking gibberish, and you know, and you're trying to present to people like you're intelligent, and indeed, often they are in their own fields. Like some of them have been a computer scientist, but being a computer scientist, I had a guy the other night come in and go, here's how I know that, you know, we set up a computer program and the internet structure and stuff like that. How does that relate to, you know, what you're talking about in remote viewing? I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, you're asking me to draw parallels or describe the difference between socks and fish. You know, don't you understand that? But they didn't. He was like, no, but you know, I was like, oh God. So I think I live a lot in my right brain. Because I believe in the eternal nature of humanity. I believe in the omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence of humanity. I believe in that. I mean, I don't believe it. I know it because I, again, have seen it with irrefutable evidence.
Exactly.
And so have you. So I believe in that. And to know that and walk through life knowing that is very definitely a right brain, you know, approach to it, to try to be walking in both worlds. But I walk in another world that I can't escape, and that other world for me is anything I see or anything I hear, I have to tear it apart, and I have to look at it and see, is it real or is it fabrication or, you know, what is this? And I even do that in my business, right? Like when I was the director of test and evaluation at the National Center for Medical Readiness. That was my job, was to, you know, people come in and say something and try to sell something, like a hypothermia prevention management kit. This was a big one. And they were fielding it into the military, especially, particularly into special operations. And it was something you were supposed to be able to put a wounded casualty in it. And it would, this looked like a sleeping bag with a particular iron, ferrous oxide liner in it, and it was supposed to warm the casualty because hypothermia is a silent killer and on the battlefield when somebody's wounded. And this thing, it wasn't working, you know, so people were saying it doesn't work. So my job was to take that and to run a test from below sea level to sea level and at 1,000 foot increments all the way up to 14,000 feet. And I did that. And you know, we had a team, and, you know, I was the guy inside the sleeping bag, so to speak. And what we determined, what we found is that at 3,000 feet, there are no longer enough moles of oxygen to to cause the ferrous oxide chemical, this reaction with ferrous oxide, to have the ferrous oxide actually create warmth. So at 3,000 feet, it became a worthless item. And they were selling it to the military for use in Afghanistan for combat up at 8,000, 12,000 feet, right? So you see what I mean? That has been my life now for 45 years, maybe, close to 50 years, is analyzing training or analyzing things like that, testing tourniquets and, you know, trying to find out how what's wrong and what's right about things. And I've listened to physicians stand up and bald-faced lie, manufacturers lie, Army officers lie, Army NCOs lie, surgeons, people in critical positions, you know, lying about the capabilities of something that they are backing, you know, financially. And so I'm distrusting of those things. And, right? And it's difficult to separate those. Yeah.
Yeah. Understandably.
So my life is that.
So your default setting, you've been programmed, and it's not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's your default setting, right? You remind me of my cameraman. His background was CNN, and, you know, so he was more entrenched in, you know, ready to debunk this stuff, right? And once in a while, we'd have a genuine experience that I know he felt and got in the moment. But he would backtrack his way out as the left brain would sink in and just go, maybe that wasn't real, you know. So my question was, have you ever had a moment where you just felt something connecting that was bigger, that just for a moment you went, oh, was that, you know, something?
No. I haven't.
Okay, well, there we go.
I'll tell you what I have had, though. I have had evidences of just a human purity and goodness, of fairness and people honoring people for the gifts and the things that I'm getting emotional for the gifts and the contributions that they've made, where, you know, in many cases, those people are ridiculed, ostracized, ignored. And then I have seen instances of where that has shifted for them. And for me, that isn't the human beings recognize the contribution of this being, of this human being. And then they, you know, there's this outpouring of love and connection. And, you know, and it is, humanity has that potential. They have that in them. And it happens frequently. We just don't get to see it as often as we would like to see it. But, you know, you can read stories like that in books. You can read stories like that, and you can see it in real life. These are the things that, for me, allow me to recognize if there's a divine, it's the divine nature of humanity. When we can either butcher each other, or we can truly express love and appreciation and uplifting and caring, contribution, service to one another. And that is within us. We've been gifted with the ability to do that. The divine nature in us that's tied to the eternal, omnipotent, omniscient, this omnipresent, which we scientifically know exists for us. That, to me, that's the divine nature of humanity. And yes, I've seen that. And yes, you know, I believe in that. I don't understand the idea of an external force, of something else stepping in and making that happen. But again, I appreciate that you do, and I understand why you do. And it's, I think it's important that you do. I do. I really do. Not to be repetitive with the do, which I just was.
We're going to have an interesting journey. One of my goals is to see if we can have Dave have a moment.
I just had a moment. I just practically broke out in tears for you talking about, you know, the things that I do.